Hello, and welcome to the podcast portion of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, previews, reviews, and interviews with baseball authors, artists, filmmakers, musicians, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. There have been dozens of guys like Jimmy Reese, Bertie Tebbets, and others who are called baseball lifers. They spend their entire professional career in the game, perhaps starting out as a player, then moving into scouting or coaching and managing, or the front office. I found there are baseball lifers among authors as well. They cover the game in a variety of ways. History, biography, co-authoring the memoirs of a player, manager, or executive. Peter Gallenbach is perhaps the best example I can think of. He has compiled oral histories about the Dodgers, Yankees, Mets, Cardinals, Cubs, and Red Sox. He's helped the likes of Sparky Lyle, Pete Rose, Ron Guidry, Johnny Damon, and Billy Martin tell their stories. He had been working on the recent Lenny Dykstra book, but got the boot, ostensibly because Dykstra didn't like the way the veteran writer was making him sound. Heck, Gallenbach even wrote a novel, a controversial story about Mickey Mantle. I asked him about the differences in producing these varied works in a recent conversation.
Peter Gallenbach, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Ron.
Now, you've been doing this a long time. Most of your books have been about baseball, not all of them, but most of them. Some are yours exclusively. I'm thinking of your team oral histories. And a lot you've done as, what would you call it, a ghostwriter, a co-author? How would you, what's the proper term?
Well, ordinarily my name is on the book, so I like to think of myself as the co-author.
Excuse me. So, right. do you prefer those types of books, or do you prefer working on your own?
Each has its own rewards. When you're working with one person, you're getting one person's view. You get to befriend that person while you're working with them. I won't say it's easier, but it's not the sort of book where you have to interview 75 people in order to write it. So that's one of its advantages, of course.
You mentioned befriend. Does that ever get in the way? When you start out with someone, do you always go in knowing that person? I imagine some of these...
No, I start out never knowing that person. Okay. You start out with them as strangers, certainly. But if you're the person who's writing, you know, say Sparky Lyle's book or Billy Martin's book or Davy Johnson's book, I mean, you want to know that person as well as you possibly can so that you can, you know, in a sense, you know, be them while you're writing it.
Do you do a lot of research about them prior to starting the assignment?
Some. I mean, you want to start your first couple of conversations, letting them know that you're not an idiot.
That always helps. Now, how do they come to you? Do they come specifically seeking you out? Does the publisher come and say, we want to work with this guy?
No, it's usually the person.
Okay, now you mentioned Sparky Lyle and Billy Martin. You've also worked with Davy Johnson and Ron Guidry, Johnny Damon.
Dark Harvey lately,
Right. And I'm thinking that some of them, not all, but they've come out fairly quickly after, like, a major event, like winning the World Series for Damon and then Davy Johnson. Does that put extra pressure on you to get it done more quickly?
Well, most of the time, the events are purely coincidental. The Damon book was not. Because obviously he had led the Red Sox to their first championship in, you know, 80 years. And so that was something of a rush. But as long as, you know, the co-author understands that we have to do this fairly quickly and gives me his 100% cooperation, you just work like a dog for several months, that's all.
Now, how do you work? Do you sit down with the person face-to-face? Do they send you audio tape? Do they send you written notes?
No. The way I like to do it, first I like to meet them. Mm-hmm. And after meeting them, what I then do, for the most part, you know, with Sparky, I lived in Englewood when I was working with Sparky, and he lived in Demarest, the next town over, two towns over. And so I would drive over to his house with my tape recorder, and we would sit and talk to each other for, you know, an hour or two, three times a week. In 1990, I moved to St. Petersburg, Florida. So most of the time, but not all the time, I'm quite a distance from the person I'm working with. And so basically what we do is we talk on the telephone, and I tape the conversation, and then I transcribe the tapes and write the first draft of the book.
During the process, and just so we know, how long does something like this take, start to, from the time you meet the person to the time where you do hand in the draft of the book?
I like to interview somebody for between 20 and 30 hours, and that often determines on when they're available. If they're available at moment's notice, it takes a shorter amount of time. You know, so some of these people are very busy, and if you can get them, you know, once a week or twice a week or whenever you can get them, often determines how long it takes.
Over the course of working with any of these people, does it ever come to a point where you might say, gee, is this what you really want to say? Do you want to reword this? Do you want to say something different? Or do you just totally let them go?
I let them go, but I don't ever want anybody to make fools out of themselves. And also sometimes, you know, you don't want to disparage people who are not public figures. I mean, you have to be a little bit careful. What I tell the people I'm working with is, you know, give me everything. Tell me absolutely everything, and then after I write the first draft, we can look at it and see. I've never really had anybody take anything out.
You also wrote a book with Bill Dennehy, who is not a real household name even among Met fans.
No, but he's been a friend of mine for 20 years.
Okay, because I was going to ask how did that project come about.
He's a lovely, lovely guy. He lives in Orlando. Mm-hmm. And I've known him for years. I knew him when I was with the Pelicans. I did a book called The Forever Boys.
Which is one of my favorite books of yours.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. I did that about the Senior League,
right,
and the Pelicans. The whole Senior League thing was so magical and wonderful. And it was also my first time living in Florida, which also made it, you know, wonderful. This was a league for former Major League ballplayers. And the Pelicans were lovely enough to allow me to spend the three-month season, you know, with them. I mean, I was a Pelican. I rode the buses as we went from St. Petersburg to visiting towns. I was their radio guy. I did the color on the radio shows, and I wrote the book. And these people were so thrilled just to be playing baseball again at a very, very high level. And it was wonderful to be there and wonderful to talk to them.
It almost makes me feel like the reverse of some of these independent leagues where these are not former major leaguers for the most part, but yet they still can't give up the game. They want to keep playing as long as possible.
Yeah, no, the love of the game is, very important to me. And I embrace those people who love it as well.
Now, most recently, you were working with Lenny Dykstra on his new book. Now, what happened there?
He cheated me. Basically, he cheated me out of my money and my credit.
Is it simple as that, or is just...
It's as simple as that.
Because he was saying that, you know, he didn't like the voice.
Oh, please. you know, basically, if you looked at the book, you know, if I said to you 90% is still there from what I wrote, you know, it's like, was there something wrong with that 90%? But, you know, everybody wants me to sue him. I live a wonderful life here in Florida. I've got great book projects that I'm working on right now. And if you go to court with somebody, it takes over your whole life. And I'm just not willing to do that.
So aside from Dykstra, let's just totally forget about him. Have you ever taken a job and then partway through you say, gee, you know, I really don't want to be doing this?
No, though I must say, you know, one time I did a book with, crying out loud, what is his name? Race car driver. Oh, for heaven's sake.
My knowledge of race cars.
Yeah, no. Ernie Irvin was his name. Okay. Ernie Irvin. And this was a really, you know, you don't know it when you sign up for a book like that. But I did quite a few books about race car drivers. My three books, American Zoom, Last Lap, and NASCAR Confidential, were among three of the bigger selling, you know, NASCAR books in NASCAR history. Anyway, so I did this book with Ernie Irvin, and one of the stories Ernie told me, he had left his first wife, you know, to be with his second, and now I gather current wife, and the second wife had said to Ernie, "I want you to get a DNA test on your children," because she knew that the first wife had sex with somebody else, and it wasn't Ernie, and so the kids were not Ernie's kids. And so Ernie did that and found out, of course, that those kids were not his. They were somebody else's. And these kids were like 12 and 10. And at that point, Ernie cut them off. Just boom. Dad disappeared. Boom. I just couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. But, you know, you sign up to do a book, and I finished the book. And then at the end of the project, his business manager says to me, "We're not approving your book." And I said, "Well, why is that?" And he says, "Well, I need $5,000, which we're going to give to my wife, and she's going to get a credit on this book." And that's what I did. Hmm. That's what I had to do to get the book approved so I could get paid.
Yeah, strange things.
I know.
Did you have a favorite person that you worked with out of all these?
So many. I've interviewed literally hundreds and hundreds of athletes. Hundreds of. Mickey Mantle, of course, is one of my all-time favorites. And that was in my very first book, Dynasty, mm-hmm. where I met him at Yankee Stadium, and he proceeded to tell me, you know, so many wonderful things, including the nightmares that he used to have, which was amazing. I mean, this was Mickey Mantle, my all-time hero, and he's telling me how after he retired, he would have nightmares where he would see himself outside Yankee Stadium, and they'd be announcing, "Now batting in the third position, number 7, and he couldn't find the door to get in. And he'd wake up in a cold sweat.
That's like an analogous to taking a test and not being able to get into the classroom.
Without a doubt. Oh, yeah, I've had those. Yeah, no, right. No, that's exactly right. And you know, some people who were so, so memorable. Billy Martin was so, so memorable to me. I love most of the people I work with. You know, Guidry and Sparky and Greg Nettles and you know, Doug Harvey lately. He's got cancer and he's very sick, but, you know, fabulous to work with. Danny, he was wonderful to work with. We had a ball. I usually have so much fun doing these books. That's the beauty of it.
Now, you said that he was a friend of yours for a long time. Did that pose any kind of problem?
No. Why would it pose a problem?
I don't know.
I mean, Dennehy's telling me his life story. It's his life story. It's any of these fellows.
Because you knew him more than you knew your other subjects. So there might have
been but you know, the same way you know your teammates on a softball team, if you know what I mean.
Uh-huh.
You know them to a certain extent, but how much do you really know them?
Okay, now you mentioned Mantle. You wrote a novel uh-huh. about him.
Yeah,
that sure was did. Somewhat controversial. Why is this your only novel?
My only novel, yeah.
Okay,
yeah, and it's mostly not a novel. I mean, it's mostly stories that Mickey and Billy and you know some of their buddies had told me along the way, and unfortunately, both Billy and Mickey were dead, and so it's not like you can call them up and say, "Hey, give me the details of these stories," because. So you have to sort of make up the details.
Were you surprised?
And that's why it was a novel.
Were you surprised at the reaction that it created?
Oh, I was so pissed. I was so, so furious.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was so unfair. And yet, it was in a way the same sort of reaction that Jim Boughton had gotten when he wrote Ball 4.
Right, for breaking cherished icons.
Yeah, but you know, I figured all the bar guys, and there are a lot of bar guys in this country, would have just absolutely loved this book. I mean, and it's still selling. I mean, people still read it and still write me, you know, emails telling me how much they love it. But you have to be that kind of person. You got to be a bar guy. You can't be one of these, you know, religious fanatics. You can't be, you know, you can't have a stick up your ass. Uh-huh.
Do you read your reviews a lot, or you just don't bother?
No, not a lot, but you know, every once in a while, you can't help yourself. When the Mantle book came out, she was in the I think the Daily News or the Post, and she was the sort of manners, Miss Manners kind of a, and she wrote an entire page. I've got it here behind me somewhere. She wrote an entire page about it. I mean, she was, you know, really miffed. How could anybody say these things about Mickey? But the truth of the matter was, that was Mickey. Mickey was the funniest person I've ever known in my whole life. And if you read the novel, you see some of his jokes. They're absolutely hysterical.
So you're obviously a person who likes to keep busy, and you did mention you're working on other projects. Is there anything you can tell us about at this point?
I have a book that I have a proposal out right now with a fellow by the name of Kurt Angle. You know Kurt Angle? He won the Olympics, the heavyweight Olympic wrestling in 1996. He became a WWE wrestler. And we've got a proposal out to do a book on his life. It's a very interesting story.
Any baseball coming down the pipe?
No, though I've had talks with certain baseball players. We shall see.
Now, obviously, you don't write just about baseball. You write about other sports, too.
Oh, yeah.
Is there, you know, baseball is traditionally the literary sport. You know, that's why I'm kind of surprised to hear about, you know, several books about race car driving. But what's your favorite sport to write about? Is it baseball, or is it something else just for the diversity?
Well, baseball is my religion. I mean, and so, you know, certainly if you write about baseball, if I write about baseball, it's what I love the most, certainly. But that doesn't mean I don't fully enjoy, you know, writing books about other things as well. Yeah. I mean, I did a book about Casey Anthony with Casey Anthony's lawyer, Jose Baez, which was a bestseller. And I had a ball doing that. I did a book with Tony Curtis called American Prince. And Tony and I just had a ball. It was just so much fun.
Is there someone you would like to do in baseball? If given the opportunity, would you say, I would love
to? I mean, it's funny. If you had asked me that way back, my answer would have been Joe DiMaggio. I mean, I must have chased Joe DiMaggio for, you know, since I wrote Dynasty back in 1975. But it was funny. Joe, just because of Marilyn Monroe, I believe. Because I would sit with Joe while he was in the clubhouse at Yankee Old Timers Day games, and he was a raconteur. He was a wonderful, wonderful storyteller. But he just didn't want to do it. I've been chasing Dave Winfield for a while. I thought that, you know, Winfield would have a very interesting story to tell, especially in that, you know, George Steinbrenner tried everything he could to bury him. But so far, Dave has been reluctant.
Do you find over the course of your long career that the stories just aren't as interesting anymore? Players who come along or more, like they don't have the same problems to deal with this is going back even before you started writing, like you know, the guys who grew up on the farm and had to overcome that kind of adversity. Like nowadays, it seems they go through the little league ranks and with personal trainers and coaches. And like I'm thinking like a Bryce Harper who was on the cover of Sports Illustrated when he was 16 years old.
Yeah,
they don't seem to have the difficulties to overcome.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the last one I did was with Dykstra, and that's a hell of a story. I mean, that's just a hell of a story.
But isn't most of the story after he finished playing?
Some of it.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of it is when he was playing. And it's crazy. I mean, he is a tiny Donald Trump. I mean, they're the same guy.
Uh-huh.
You know, and yes, he screwed me. But on the other hand, I had a ball working with him. We had so much fun for a long, long time. And it's funny because he had a clause in my contract, and it was in there from the time I signed it, and I knew damn well that the possibility exists that he was going to screw me, and by gosh, he did.
Well, it's a good thing you planned for that.
Well, you never plan for it. You never really know, but you know, sometimes you take a chance. You hope.
And we have
it's like, okay, they did it to them, but, you know, maybe you won't do it to you.
maybe for the next time. We've been talking with Peter Gallenbach, author of many wonderful books on baseball, including oral histories of teams like the Yankees, the Cubs, the Cardinals, the Red Sox. Which was your favorite team to work with for those?
Well, I mean, my life changed when Marty Appel, who was the assistant PR guy at the Yankees, I said to him, you know, I'd like to write, you know, a history of the Yankees. And he said to me, if you can get a contract, you can come to Yankee Stadium and do your research here. And I was working as an attorney at Prentice Hall at the time. And I went down to the trade book editor and I said to him, you know, the Yankees will let me do the research at the stadium if you'll give me a contract to write a book on the Yankees. And it turned out the editor, whose name was Nick Danchenko, I will always forever be grateful to him, said, okay, and he gave me a contract. And I went to the Yankees, and Marty was good to his word. And I spent a whole year at Yankee Stadium in 72 and 73. It was one of the most wonderful years of my life. I would go out onto the field during lunchtime, and who was it? That Ronnie, the first DH, Ron Bloomberg, and a couple of his boys. They want to take batting practice, and so I'd put a glove on, stand out in the outfield, and shag for them. You know, I would go out to lunch at Joe DiMaggio's favorite Goomba restaurant with the staff. I mean, I just had, you know, such a wonderful time. And Mike Burke, who was the president of the Yankees at the time, he had left CBS. He wrote me this fabulous letter that said, you know, to whom it may concern, please give Peter Gallenbach as much cooperation as you possibly can. And I sent this letter around and basically got to interview every single Yankee from 1949 to 1964 except Joe DiMaggio.
Wow. Now, again, since you've been at it so long, you must have seen tremendous changes in the way the publishing industry works.
Unfortunately.
Talk about that a little bit. You know, how is that from your first few books, from the Dynasty book, from The Bums, which is about the Brooklyn Dodgers? It seems that authors are now called upon to do a lot more in the marketing of the book than they ever used to. I guess that's a factor in the publishing industry cutting back on publicity and things of that nature.
Well, see, the difference was back then, they would give you a contract, and they really didn't care whether your book sold or not. I never could quite understand it. They did give me contracts for these books, and their publicity staffs were so awful that basically you would do, you know, three radio shows, and if you were lucky, you'd do a TV show for some of the books. I mean, I had a huge, huge amount of publicity that some of these publishers would send me across the country for 6 or 7 days. All across the country. And you get tremendous, tremendous publicity. But don't forget, back then you had Larry King's fabulous show on the radio. The show would be from midnight to 3 o'clock, and then he would repeat it from 3 o'clock to 6 o'clock.
And almost every big baseball fan.
Huge baseball fan. He was a friend of Sandy Koufax's when he was growing up. Mm-hmm. So when I did Bums, he was a huge, huge fan. He's in the book, as a matter of fact. Larry King is in that book. Howard Cosell was a huge fan of mine. I used to do Howard Cosell's Speaking of Sports or Speaking of Everything, you know, with every book that I would write. And, you know, the TV opportunities were endless as well back then, where they did talk shows where they had authors. The problem today is that you don't see talk shows anymore with authors. You know, Oprah used to do that once a month, which was great. It would make that one author, you know, fairly famous and rich. But TV is such that viewers don't want authors. They want famous people. They want celebrities. And so it's almost never do you go on a talk show and talk about your book.
That seems kind of funny in today's age of cable where you have 1,000 stations. You figure some of those stations could be devoted to pop culture and the arts and literature.
Well, it's the strangest thing. I mean, there was a time when I was on ESPN's documentaries. They did tons of documentaries. They did biographies of all sorts of people. And I was on all of them. And that was very, very good publicity. Even today on Yankeeography, if you ever go to the Yes Network, you see the Yankeeography, and I'm on, you know, so many of those things. But that's, you know, 20 years ago. That doesn't happen anymore. It doesn't seem that the publishing companies do very much publicity and promotion at all.
Do you have a web presence?
Very strange. No.
Not into that?
No.
No.
I did. I'm just too busy.
That's great.
You know, my son keeps telling me you gotta have tweet followers. You gotta tweet. You know, which is a wonderful idea, but
if you have the time.
And if you have something to say, I mean, you know, I'm sitting
doesn't
here
seem to stop some people.
No, that's true. That's very true. Make them president.
And no, on that, we're going to say thank you, Peter Gollenbach. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for all the wonderful literature you've provided to us through the years.
You're very kind, Ron. Thanks so much.
And that was our conversation with Peter Gollenbach. I wish I could say tune in again next time, but to be honest, I don't know when next time is going to be, as I struggle to finish my project on Hank Williams in his season of 1938. And in the meantime, you may have noticed the posts haven't been as frequent as they have been. I hope to alleviate that as soon as the book is in and the edits are done and I can relax for a little bit. In the meantime, I still check my mail regularly, so if you have any questions or suggestions, please send them to me at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody. See you soon. But the extras don't carry his name. If old man Columbus had sat in the stands, had seen Matty pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Cheers.